My name is Kees van der Puijl. I'm from Holland. I was born in Dordrecht and I studied in Leiden. I studied law and political science. And I got a job in 1973 at the University of Amsterdam in international relations. And there I also did my doctoral thesis on the making of an Atlantic ruling class. That was my first book also in English with Verso. In 2000, I changed to the University of Sussex in Brighton in the UK. And there I stayed until retirement in 2012. I've written various books and also a few novels in Dutch. Most of my written work is in English, meanwhile, but also translated. My recent books are, my most recent book is about, it's called in Dutch, The Pandemic of Fear. And in the American edition, it's called States of Emergency. And it's also in a few other languages. I'm still negotiating with France and some other countries to get a translation published there. And the book that is also relevant today is one that I published in 2018 with Manchester University Press. And it's called Flight MH17, Ukraine and the New Cold War.
Okay, so that's a pretty comprehensive list. But Keith, I first came across you as a journalist fresh out of the BBC with your book about the Atlantic ruling class, where you were one of the few academics that had really looked at the Bilderberg conferences. And I wonder what you make of why it is that these, I mean, it's quite clear that people have been meeting there since the 1950s, why academia was so apparently shy of looking at the Bilderbergers, because they clearly had a lot of power, a lot of financial power and political power, and yet much of academia just ignored them.
Well, to be honest, it was my topic, so in that sense, I didn't have to drop anything when I went through the years at in these two universities that I worked. But I must say that there is a sort of silent agreement in academia that you stick to the main topics that are on the table. So it's not easy. It requires a very peculiar environment to break with traditional topics in research. So, for instance, in political science, you normally would be engaged with electoral systems and that sort of thing. And in international relations, you would be concerned with either the Cold War or let's say development and underdevelopment. And our group in Amsterdam in the 1970s broke with that because we wanted to find out about the origin of the European integration process. And well, working on that and realizing that the Dutch capitalist class is small but extremely influential, we discovered that the reason it was influential was because it worked through these transnational networks. And Bilderberg was one of them, was actually initiated by Dutch people, by, you know, Prince Bernhard was the prince consort, was the nominal head, but the real driving force was Paul Rijkens, who was the head of Unilever at the time. And he was a political visionary, seen from the perspective of the ruling class, who at several junctures really looked far beyond where the mainstream of the capitalist class was looking. And he also understood that from a small country, where capital is big, but the country and the population are relatively small, you have to get organized across borders. And that's what he did with Bilderberg. Bilderberg has a very interesting prehistory in wartime London. And later, of course, when Bilderberg landed in a crisis in the 1970s, late 1960s, the Trilateral Commission branched off from it to include Japan. And, well, also in the early 1970s, you had the World Economic Forum, and all these groups became more and more sophisticated and to some extent also less secretive. Less secretive in the sense that they developed a very sophisticated public relations arm, so without ever becoming truly open. And, well, today we have a very rich landscape of all kinds of groups. Of course, the most famous one across borders, but also every national setting has its own networks in which ruling class people are in conversation with the national politicians, with the media, and so on. So it's a bit like Freemasonry of old, that even when the working class was ascendant and trade unions were growing, the ruling class and the middle classes were always better organized because they already looked beyond borders and they arranged matters in such a way that you see that very clearly in France, that whenever the French ruling class felt powerless against its own workers and farmers and so on, that they could count on Germany, for instance, to come to the rescue, which they did several times. So both in the war in 1870 and in the Second World War.
You said that there was an interesting prehistory in wartime London to Bilderberg. Can you just explain, what was going on? And because I've come across certainly quite a lot of evidence about the Council on Foreign Relations back in 1943, I think it was, during the war, the War and Peace Studies group there, getting together and saying, well, in order to make the most of the opportunities post-war, we need to set up this group, which eventually, 10 years after the end of the war, became the Bilderbergs. But maybe you could just share about, what was going on in London during the war.
Well, in wartime London, there was a gathering of people from continental Europe whose countries had been overrun by the Nazis. And in wartime London, there was a lot of planning about what a post-war world would look like and how the rise of an ultra-nationalist phenomenon like the Nazis could be prevented in the future. And this guy that I mentioned, Paul Reikens of Unilever, he was really an animating spirit in wartime London, setting up a number of networks. He also worked with a Polish representative because, of course, Poland had been overrun and had been divided between Nazi Germany and Soviet Union initially, until the Nazis then invaded the USSR as well. Sikorski was the head of the Polish government in exile in London. He was killed at some point, but his secretary, Joseph Rettinger, who was the model, apparently, for Ian Fleming for his James Bond character. Because Rettinger was a real adventurer. For instance, when the Red Army was approaching Warsaw, it was judged best to try and arrange an uprising in Warsaw so that Warsaw would be liberated from the Nazis by the Poles themselves before the Red Army arrived. Rettinger was dropped by parachute with an enormous amount of money, cash money, on him to help the uprising succeed. And he became the first secretary of Bilderberg in the 1950s when it was set up. not as a secret planning organization, by the way, but to try and overcome the very profound differences of opinion that were raging at the time and threatening to disrupt the incipient Atlantic unity between the US and the main European, continental European countries. And that those had to do with the fact that, for instance, Germany wanted to trade with the Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and with the USSR itself, and the US wanted to prevent that. And there were other issues that divided the Atlantic partners, so they wanted a group being able to discuss these matters in all openness, and therefore it had to be behind closed doors, otherwise...
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that those issues are still very much, in fact, over the last couple of months the Russians have come into Ukraine. The trade, I mean, we've even heard just today in March, the end of March 2022, Keith, that the Russians are insisting that the gas is paid for in rubles. All of a sudden, the trade barriers are starting to go up. But I mean, look, that before we get into that, I wonder if you could take us through what you think has been the Bilderbergers' influence over the years. These people are clearly very powerful, very wealthy. They aren't what you might call secret, but I know, you know, they have a very peculiar. One of the first times I came across them as a journalist straight out of mainstream media, I saw a press release from them saying not for publication, which is a bizarre thing to see written on the top of a press release. So They are quite clearly the many journalists at the top level and editors would have known about them, but also known to keep mum.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. But I think networks like Bilderberg are best understood as relays of an evolving consensus among powerful people, rather than as a center in which the ideas that they are going to put into practice are originating. Therefore, it's not so easy to pinpoint a particular political decisions or political events of great importance, and then trace them back to a particular Bilderberg meeting.
No, I agree with you. But you see, what we've seen is we've seen things like, you know, the president. Clinton, Tony Blair, many others turning up at a Bilderberg conference, and then suddenly, you know, within the next couple of years, they are running the show.
No, that's true, and you might say it's a sort of entrance exam to show your face at events like these, and of course it's invitation only. It's not you and me crashing in. Somebody like, for instance, Emmanuel Macron, the current president of France, he rose very much. One of the routes along which he rose was his acquaintance with Henry Kravis of Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, which was the pioneer hedge fund in the 1980s and 90s. And Henry Kravis was married to a French lady, and she is in the governing board of Bilderberg today, and Macron therefore was, and there are many other people that you can mention as his patrons, but one of the routes that he took was his visits to New York to the Kravises, and the invitation that he got to also appear at Bilderberg. And there, I guess, he was vetted by the likes of Henry Kissinger or whatever people were gathered at the sessions that he attended.
Well, I mean, as a Dutchman, I've got to ask you, Keith, about Prince Bernhard, because, you know, he was in the SS before the war. He then kind of made friends with the Dutch royal family, and he was at the chairman of the first 20 years of Bilderberg. So what do you make of him?
Well, that's an interesting story because as an SS officer, he was actually received by Hitler, and he got the instruction or suggestion to try and court either a Danish princess or, in this case, a Dutch princess. And Bernard was very much a ladies' man. And, well, with due respect, our then, the daughter of our then Queen Wilhelmina, was not the most beautiful woman around. So Bernard really took this upon himself as a duty on behalf of Germany. He came from a large landowning family. Well, that's how he ended up. He courted our Princess Juliana and eventually married her and famously womanized along, you know. I think in his role in Bilderberg is very much a nominal role. He was a figurehead. He was not a strategist like Paul Reikens was, the Unilever man that I mentioned, or that Joseph Rettinger was. I personally know by my student from my student days. I know the man who was a friend, close friend of Bernard, of Prince Bernard, Ernst van der Beugel. Ernst van der Beugel was a Dutch state secretary for foreign affairs, the president of KLM Airlines, and a number, you know, one of these guys with a whole portfolio of directorships. And van der Beugel became the acting secretary of Bilderberg with an office in The Hague. And the current secretary of Bilderberg is, what's his name, the economist, Victor Halberstadt. He was a sort of adopted son of van der Beugel. So it's interesting to see that this vast network bringing in prominent people from all over the Atlantic world, actually at its core is a very inbreeding and narrow circle of people, all from the Netherlands.
Yeah, so it's the NATO countries, pretty much, that's the focus of the Bilderbergers. I just wonder what you make of their relationship. I know Mike Peters, back in the 1990s, did a terrific paper, which was quite sardonically written, even though it was a brilliant piece of academic research, fully referenced and everything, where he links this very much to the evolution of the EU. And I wonder what you think is going on with the EU, whether it's there, as we're told, as a, you know, and as a bulwark against the next world war, or whether it's simply a kind of plaything for the ruling classes.
Or
somewhere in between.
Well, the EU, if you link the EU to these transnational networks like Bilderberg, Bilderberg would not be the primary route for advocates of European integration to go. You know, you have the European Federalist Movement, you have a number of other networks that meanwhile have lost their relevance largely. As things stand now, I would say that the EU has entered the final phase of its existence, for the simple reason that today, it will be easier to travel from a European country, from an EU country to a non-EU country, let's say from Holland to Norway, than to go from Holland to Germany. And that is because the EU is planning to introduce these digital IDs, which will be required for you to cross European boundary inside the EU. Another very interesting issue that just pops up in my mind. At some point, a former student of mine from Amsterdam actually worked for a Dutch minister of defense, former Dutch minister of defense, and had been asked to clean out his archive. And in his archive, he found the documents of a number of Bilderberg conferences that this minister had attended. And in them, he found a conference of 1989 in which Bilderberg discussed the response to the collapsing Soviet Union. And there, that was my only experience in which I could see that in these documents, there were very clear indications that at Bilderberg, it was discussed, should we extend a helping hand to Gorbachev or make sure that he fails and that the whole Soviet episode ends here and now. And in that sense, I would say that that's my only experience in looking at a crucial historical event, maybe the historical event if you look at the 20th century, after World War II, in which you can say that a Bilderberg conference more or less prepared a crucial, or at least was one of the moments in which the ruling classes of the Atlantic world prepared for a consensus on how to deal with the Gorbachev challenge. And that was in its final stages. So it was in 89 when basically Gorbachev was also at the end of his wits and all his options had been tried and failed.
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly from my reading of the way they operate is the, as events are unfolding, so Bilderberg will reveal its steering committee's thoughts about them just to see whether the various outsiders who are at Bilderberg, whether they're press, as we had, for example, Will Hutton from the Observer, who went to one of their meetings, and he certainly wasn't 100% on board. In fact, he wrote an article very critical of them when he got back. And the politicians, the up-and-coming politicians, just to see which of these organizations are on side. And I suppose if they, at the end of the conference, the steering committee sees, well, this person is with us, then they will be able to react accordingly. And perhaps, that's part of their strategy to get these ideas out there through the press or through politics and policy into action. But anyway, look, let's move on and look at your take on the pandemic, if you don't mind, Keith, because, I mean, I like the Pandemic of Fear as a title of a book, because it does seem as if We've been, for the first time for a long time, we've seen a very consistent, right across the mass media, use of fear to literally to get people to do things that they might otherwise not have done if they were fully conversant with all of the evidence. So anyway, why did you choose Pandemic of Fear as the title?
Well, because in hindsight, it turned out that from the 1990s, after the Soviet Union collapsed, and let's say the bottom of political consensus in the West fell out of it, that there was no longer a sort of backstop to convince people that whatever might happen, you still had to be against communism and so on and so forth. And side with your government. After 1991, it turned out that, on the one hand, that sort of basic political consensus fell away, but also the capitalist system as such was no longer capable of offering a meaningful social contract to its citizens. And in that period, you see that a number of important conferences are taking place, and also, you know, ideological experiments like the idea of Huntington, of a clash of civilizations, and so on. But I think especially of a conference held under the chairmanship of Philip Zelikow of 9/11 fame. Zelikow was the director of the Miller Center of the University of Virginia, and he organized a conference about how political science should be rethought to be prepared for the coming period. And in that, he said that if you look back on political history, you would see that, for instance, an event like Pearl Harbor inspired a whole generation of citizens to side with the government, because basically they had been witness to an event of such magnitude and of such a shock that it would be useful to reconsider whether, if something like that happened again, we wouldn't have another 30 years in which there would be a consensus about why it was proper to follow your government in this or in that. And the idea of a politics of fear was therefore slowly worked out in the 1990s. And in 2003, there was actually this famous BBC documentary about how the American dream had evaporated. And you now had the power of nightmares, so you could make people fearful, and with people who are in fear, who live in fear, you can do a lot. And in my view, if you look at the figures, it was obvious that in May, June 2020, whatever pandemic or epidemic there had been, it had passed. And in the book, I list a number of highly placed experts who came to that conclusion, that it was best to quickly revert to normalcy to avoid further panic and so on and so forth. But what actually happened was that the panic was kept going by making reference to number of infected people and all kind of calculus, you know, all kind of figures that really made very little sense in an epidemiological sense, but worked very well if the media were on side and were helping to spread this deep unease, you know. Don't forget that a virus is, unlike the Russians or even terrorism, a virus is a very handy theme to instill fear in people, because it's you can't see it. People associate it with illness and even death, as in the case of AIDS. And so in that sense, it worked excellently. And to my own surprise, when I started investigating this in greater depth, I was surprised to see that already in the late 1980s, there had been conferences about bioterrorism and the responses to it, and how the population might be brought on board in a repressive policy, you know, in which people would gladly surrender their freedoms just to make sure that they would be protected against the horrors of an unknown illness and so on and so forth. So,
well, this is quite worrying. I just wondered if you can pick out a couple of points that you make in the book without spoiling things for people. You know, what are the central things that you've concluded?
Well, the basic argument, and that's best brought out in the American edition, which is called States of Emergency, and the subtitle of that is keeping the global population in check. And the main argument in the book is that, especially after 2008, people all across the globe have become restive. So I wasn't so much aware of that before I looked at the figures. But if you look at statistics for strikes, for anti-government demonstrations, for occupations, for actual revolutions like the Arab Spring and so on, but also in France, for instance, the Yellow Vest. If you look at all these statistics, you see that especially after 2008, the year of the final financial collapse, you might say, these statistics have all gone up. Not just that, they have broken all existing records. And that means that after 2008, the ruling classes of the world, and that again reverts back to these networks, you know, ruling class is a very abstract term. But if you think of these networks like Bilderberg, Trilateral, World Economic Forum, and so on and so forth, in all these networks, the focus increasingly became, how are we keeping this restive mass and rapidly growing mass? Don't forget, in 1970, when I started work in Amsterdam, there were 4 billion people on Earth. Today, we're approaching 8 billion. So we have seen a doubling of the world population. And in a digital capitalism, a capitalism that we're rapidly approaching now, that's, you know, digitalization is being introduced in every nook and cranny of the economy and public administration and so on, many of these people will be superfluous. And calculations have been made about something like 2 billion people literally being unnecessary in the society that would come if the capitalist system would continue and would enter the modernization stage that is now being made possible by digitalization, so by the internet and by everything that's associated with it. So that's the bottom line. The bottom line is the ruling classes are faced with a world population that's getting more and more rebellious, that is becoming aware of the fact that for many of them, and of course among the young, that's always the most alive, for many of them there won't be any future role, there won't be, certainly not a guaranteed minimum existence and so on. And the virus option, just as before it, the terror option, the idea of the threat posed by Russia and perhaps also China, that these are instances of a politics of fear in which, at least in the short run, the ruling classes hope to keep the masses divided, at bay, under control, etc. And that's not just a matter of Western capitalism. It's also a matter of China, for instance. I saw some video images the other day of the city of Shenzhen, which is the hub of Chinese high-tech industry opposite Hong Kong. And you could see that the police was no longer able to contain furious masses who were protesting a renewed lockdown that was being imposed there. So in that sense, the lockdowns have been a response, just as the terror scares were a response, to a population that is increasingly difficult to control and to whom the ruling classes have less and less to offer in terms of, you know, a stable future, a future of work, proper chances for their children to study and so on, being taken care of should you fall ill and you name it. So that's the argument of the book. And yeah, it has chapters also on the bio warfare laboratories of the United States, both inside the US and abroad, including in China. Some of these biowarfare laboratories in China, paradoxically, because they are also directed against China and against Russia. But some of these laboratories are actually working for the United States in China. And the famous Wuhan laboratory, for instance, was a subcontractor to a U.S. Project to work on upgrading so-called gain-of-function research, that is upgrading viruses that were collected from the droppings of bats in the mountains of southern China, and were developed in Wuhan in that particular laboratory at the cost on a commission from the United States.
So what about your latest book about the MH17? Because, of course, this is becoming more interesting as the situation in Ukraine hots up. So maybe we can talk about both separately, the MH17 first. Yeah. I mean, the reason that, of course, that the Dutch are interested in it was a flight from Holland.
Yeah.
That has been investigated in Holland, which of course is a NATO country. So, if this, you know, it could be used as a hostile way of having a go at a non-NATO country, which happens in this case to be Russia, saying it was the Russians that shot it down. So I wonder, what are the main conclusions you've come to? I think we can, to a certain extent, discount the official inquiry because it seems to be extremely one-sided. And even the Malaysians themselves, which was a Malaysian airliner, MH17, have been very critical of the fact that they have been, in some cases, completely shut out of the investigation, even though it was their aircraft.
Yeah, exactly. And it was not the first aircraft that they lost. That they also lost an aircraft several months earlier over the South China Sea, or at least somewhere around Vietnam. This book is from 2018 in the English version, and it's not so that in the book I come to the conclusion that I cannot say who shot it down with certainty. But if you look at the most of the book is about how the West in 2014, on the back of all kinds of unrest in Ukraine, how the West engineered a coup which brought to power in Kiev the ultra-nationalists that today are fighting with Russia. And from the details, I would now, with even more emphasis, suggest that the plane was brought down to ensure a European consensus that was lacking at the time to introduce new energy sanctions against Russia that played in 2014. And the United States wanted severe energy sanctions against Russia over the decision of Crimea to rejoin the Russian Federation. Something which was welcomed for obvious reasons by the Russian Federation, because Russia has the very important naval base in Sevastopol on the Crimea, which and Crimea itself is like a sort of fixed aircraft carrier commanding the Black Sea. If that would have become a NATO naval base, which was the obvious plan, then Russia would have been shut out of the Black Sea for all practical purposes. So one way or another, they had to intervene. And developments comparable to that are again at play today. So again, Russia is responding with force this time to a threat that Ukraine was allowing the United States to build two state-of-the-art naval installations, one in Berdyansk on the Sea of Azov, and the other in Olshakov, which is south of Mykolaiv. I don't know to what extent you have the map ready in your mind, but that's on the west of Crimea. So one on the west and one on the east. And Russia was very concerned about the quality of naval equipment and communications equipment that was to be installed in these naval stations that will be under construction at the time. Both in the meantime, in the first day of the military operation, have been destroyed. So there is no longer a basis in Oshakov and neither in Berdyansk. I would say that in 2014, the European states were not willing to follow the US lead in introducing new energy sanctions on Russia until MH17 was shot down. And then in that same week, the entire EU went along with these new sanctions after all. And it also had to do with the fact that a new pipeline was being projected across the Black Sea, so-called South Stream, just as we're seeing today with Nord Stream 2. South Stream was abandoned. It would have been the most expensive and the longest pipeline in history. Nord Stream 2 is the double of Nord Stream 1, which is already in operation, straight from Russia across the Baltic Sea to Germany. Nord Stream 2 is parallel to that. It has been constructed, has been paid for, etc. So it's an enormous loss for Russia that they did that for nothing, at least as things stands now. Both in 2014 and today, I think energy is really very important in the as a background factor, although ultimately it's about the West, led by the United States, wanting to impose a global system of governance in which they decide matters, and Russia and behind it China and to some extent Iran are unwilling to submit to that leadership. So that's the situation that we're in.
What about the US in Ukraine, though? Because I do wonder whether, I mean, surely the European countries, they have overriding interests. Why should they listen to anything the US says? I mean, they may be, security concerns of their own with Russia, and yet we're constantly hearing, oh, the US is meddling in European affairs. But I don't necessarily see much evidence of that on the ground. These European countries surely can make up their own mind about what they're doing with Russia and their relationships with the Russians and their activities in Ukraine, too.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, don't forget that the Baltic countries, for instance, have large Russian minorities carried over from their from the Soviet era. So Latvia and Estonia have a quarter of their population is Russian. So they are very concerned that since they're treating these people very badly, they are very concerned that at some point there will be conflicts inside their own societies and so on. And generally speaking, you might say that the Baltic countries, but also Poland, are anti-Russian and want NATO to revert to its original 1949 mission, which on paper at least was to resist a possible Soviet invasion. In Western Europe, on the other hand, the so-called old Europe, that has been replaced by sort of Atlantic, more political, economic relationship. And they're not concerned, of course. They know that Russia has no appetite for military adventures in the Western direction. So NATO basically is a disciplining mechanism by which the United States and the Atlantic element in various European countries ensures that there is no breaking of ranks by individual countries. And that began already very clearly in the post-Soviet era with the conflict over Yugoslavia, when several countries, like Italy, for instance, didn't want to intervene militarily in Yugoslavia at all, until NATO acted in 1995 and again in 1999 with fairly useless actions, very destructive in many ways, causing lasting antagonism with both Russia and China, because you may recall that in 1999 they bombed, NATO bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, claiming later that it was because they had were using old maps, but in fact it was a decision meant to show the Chinese who was boss. But already at that time you could see that NATO worked as a disciplinary mechanism to prevent any countries from breaking ranks, and today is the same. For instance, Hungary is clearly not willing to antagonize Russia too much. It's entirely dependent on Russian gas. And it has indicated that it didn't want to join sanctions against Russia. Turkey, which is also a very important client for Russian gas, also didn't want to join the sanctions at all, which is quite amazing if you think it's the second largest army inside NATO. So starting a war and starting hostilities is the ultimate card that NATO can play to ensure that there are no defectors from its own ranks. But that cannot be kept going endlessly. So my own feeling is that both for NATO and the EU, we're looking at a sort of end game in which the last cards are being played. And since, as far as I can see, Russia is succeeding in its game plan for Ukraine, although it does so with a relatively small military forces, I think NATO and the EU will come out of this very much weakened, and with a resurgence, we will see a resurgence of internal dissent and disagreement.
Okay, what do you make of the these Russian claims about denazification? Because this is very counterintuitive, isn't it? The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is Jewish. I mean, surely he's not going to be harboring Nazis and you know, as part of his army. That sounds very unlikely.
Yeah, that's true, but that's only true if you go for the idea that Nazism was primarily an anti-Jewish philosophy, and you know, the history of fascism shows that it's a form of violent repression of a population, basically a strategy of dealing with the working class through a policy of violence, which in some cases will use extreme nationalism as a mobilization factor, sometimes enlarged by hatred whipped up against a particular ethnic group. You know, Italian fascism, which is a classical form, was not anti-Semitic. Mussolini had a Jewish girlfriend. And it was only under extreme German pressure that Italy in 1938 went over to an anti-Semitic policy, and then even not with extreme enthusiasm. In Germany, it was a different matter. In Ukraine, the people who were brought to power were ultra-nationalists who were indeed anti-Semitic, but even more so anti-Russian and anti-Polish. They had positions of power in the new government of February 2014, which were completely out of proportion with their real weight in society. But ever since, they have succeeded in gaining hold and becoming accepted across society. Zelensky is Jewish. His patron is a a very powerful and very vicious oligarch in Western Ukraine, Kolomoisky. He's also Jewish. And yet I would call these people fascists. You know, Kolomoisky became notorious for the fact that he offered bounties of $1,000 or $2,000 for every Russian killed. So it sounds counterintuitive that under a Jewish president, the Nazi element would be very prominent in Ukraine, and yet that is what is the case. I mean, to me, I don't know how you think about it, but to me, the whole category of Jewish is very problematic, because basically it's either a religion or it's a nationality in the case of Israel. You can't say that in Israel there's a very strong anti-fascist sentiment either. You know, they're also misbehaving against the populations and that they gained control of thanks to their conquests in 1967. So denazification from a Russian point of view is, of course, it's slightly over the top and propagandistic to use the term in this way without further clarification. But it is a fact that the ultra-nationalists and fascists who came to power in 2014 with the support of the United States, actually also a very interesting story is how the EU tried to mediate between the then president and the far-right opposition, but they were shoved aside by the US. But the people who were brought to power then and the ideology that they brought with them has permeated Ukrainian society to a very large degree. So it has become normalized, and the far right actual fascist group like the Azov battalion, which is now actually a regiment of several battalions and a whole lot of others that I can mention, have become integrated in the Ukrainian National Guard, and the National Guard is integrated in the Ukrainian army. So the boundary lines that you could still claim existed in the run-up to the February 2014 coup, these boundary lines have been very much transcended in the current situation, and the whole ideology, not of all people in Ukraine, but of a large part of the population, the political culture in the country has become saturated with anti-Russian sentiment, and anti-Semitic sentiment is completely marginalized by that and no longer plays a role, as far as I can see, which it still did in 2014.
Well, I know, just to finish, Keith, I'd like to be quite cruel to you, if you don't mind, and ask you to look into your crystal ball. Tell us how long this Russian so-called special operation, the occupation of an invasion of Ukraine, is going to take and how it's going to finish.
Well, I have no independent source of information except for a few people that I correspond with who are in Ukraine. But I follow the analysis of Scott Ritter, you know, the former U.S. Marine, Marine intelligence officer, who was a weapons inspector in Iraq in the run-up to the invasion of 2003. And he says that the Russian invasion is really a special operation, because an invasion would require an army that at least would be four times as large as the current army that entered Ukrainian territory, and basically what they want to achieve is demilitarization. So they have destroyed all the bases, of which I mentioned, for instance, these naval bases being constructed under U.S. auspices on the Black Sea, but also other training grounds that have been operated by NATO. And they want to disarm the Nazis. And for instance, that is why the battle over Mariupol, port city near Donetsk, and inside Donetsk province, oblast. Why it was so bitter? Because that was the city that was being defended by the Azov regiment. I think that it will take another month before the capitulation will be signed, because that's inevitable, for the simple reason that all Ukrainian communications and command and control structures were destroyed in the first few days of the operation. And that means that the large army that Ukraine had ready to invade and repossess the Donbas rebel areas, that army has now been deprived of communications. Of it's no longer refueled, they've lost their ammo supply, and so on and so forth. And once that army surrenders, which is inevitable, I think the final negotiations will come about, and they will be about Ukraine formally declaring it will not become a member of NATO under any circumstances, and so on and so forth. It's a murky affair, you know. There's never any reason to glorify military operations, because you already the signs are there that not only Ukraine has given up on any semblance of democracy, you know, all opposition parties have been outlawed, the Russian broadcast is no longer allowed, and so on. But Russia too will enter a phase in which the state will take a more active role in controlling society. And although I broadly think it's inevitable that at some point they would have to clamp down on the what you might call the Atlantic fraction inside Russia, that doesn't mean that life will therefore become more attractive inside Russia. You know, once you identify a fifth column, a category of traitors, etc., you can begin to see very unpleasant developments in the political culture. So it's not just in Ukraine itself, but also in Russia, that you see the negative consequences once you resort to war, and once certain categories of people are identified as working for the enemy, and so on. That usually doesn't lead to opening up of a pleasant era of open and liberal political relations inside that country.
No, that's quite true. Anyway, Keith, I wonder if you could just remind listeners how they can follow you and maybe get hold of your books.
Well, for English speaking people, it has been published by Clarity Press in Atlanta, Georgia. Unfortunately, after initial striking success and some fantastic reviews, a spoiler edition was brought on the market, also on Amazon, which was half the size of the real book, and led to very negative comments of people who purchased it.
But okay, which book is this?
This is the book States of Emergency, which is the book on the pandemic of fear, so to speak. And the other book, the book on MH17, was published in English by Manchester University Press in the UK.
Do you have a blog or Twitter, that sort of thing, social media?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter. If you type in my name, you'll find me on Twitter. So far, I haven't been removed on any ground.
So you better spell it, Keith, and also give us the correct pronunciation for us Brits. Pronouncing Dutch names is a little bit awkward.
No. My Twitter address is KEES VDPIJL1.
Okay, and how do we pronounce your name?
Kees van der Peel. Yeah, the IJ combination doesn't exist in other languages, but that's how we fought for our freedom against Spain in the 16th century, and ever since have used the I and the J combination in this sense.
Anyway, Kees van der Peel, I hope I said it right. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.